Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, the geekiest photo podcast out there. At least I like to think that it is. If it isn't, then I'd like somebody to challenge me on that and show me their podcast that covers the topics more in depth or chooses the topics of such a geeky nature that we do. We don't like to cover all of the mainstream stuff. So if you're looking for something that's a little bit different, you have certainly found it. Joining me today, again, probably the most acclaimed guest, Steve Brazel. Steve, how are you doing today?
I'm doing quite well. I don't know that I can live up to that one, but I'm doing really well. How are you?
Great. Actually, I've had compliments on your appearances on this podcast, both in email and on recordings of other things and in person. So you are much loved by this audience.
Which is good, because that means that when I sent your email address to all of my family members, it worked.
There you go. It most certainly did. What's new and exciting with you, Steve?
Nothing, just all the normal stuff. Still doing the podcast, Behind the Shot at behindtheshot.tv. I've got great guests lined up, and I just actually had, from a music photographer point of view, a hero of mine, David Bergman is the tour photographer for the band Bon Jovi since 2010. He's a Canon Explorer Light. He has 14 Sports Illustrated covers. And actually, you'll appreciate this one. I thought of you when we brought this up. When Obama did his first inauguration speech, there's a famous Gigapan image, which is a huge resolution image of yep. that inauguration speech. And it was David Bergman that did that shot.
Oh, cool.
And as I'm talking to him, he mentioned something to me. I said, oh, yeah, you know, you can zoom in and you can see detail in the clothes. He goes, no. You can actually zoom in on the band's sheet music and read the sheet music.
Really? Wow.
And I'm okay. Now I got to do it. And I went and checked, and sure enough, you can zoom in on the sheet music. It's amazing.
That is so cool. I mean, technology is pushing photography into many different ways. I mean, that's why this podcast exists, to discuss all of the different paths that photography is going to take. And that kind of resolution is unfathomable if you go, you know, even a few years before it was made.
Yeah. And that's, you know, you said that yours is the most geeky podcast, but what I really kind of look at your podcast as, and the reason I like your podcast, is in many ways, the topics that you cover, you know, it's kind of like the thing that in 2001, A Space Odyssey, we saw them holding handheld tablet computers, which effectively happened, you know, 30, 40 years later. In many ways, what you talk about on your shows, this high tech kind of angle towards photography, really is foretelling the future.
I suppose it is. I mean, a version of it, and the future might not turn out exactly the way that we expect, but it's using all the breadcrumbs that we have right now and extrapolating exactly what that's going to turn into. You know, there was a company based out of, I think it was Kitchener-Waterloo area here in Ontario, that just got a bunch of patents for holographic lenses in eyewear passed within the last couple of days. And it's not one of the stories we're talking about today, but you look at that and think, okay, well, Google Glass failed. I don't know if it was the technology or if it was just socially unacceptable, but if you could just make it look like a regular pair of glasses and it's displaying augmented reality through that, that would be something very cool, and it might have a place. So photography wraps into all of these new areas of technology that change the way that we see the world.
And ties into art, because really what you just described was Geordi's glasses on the Next Generation.
Oh, absolutely. Right? In fact, so, I would love if they looked like that. That would be fantastic.
Now, that would be awesome. Either that or those really weird-looking contacts.
Right. Well, and speaking of new tech, I have in my hands here the red hydrogen smartphone.
Yeah, thanks.
And so this is an early version of it. The hardware is final, but the software is continuously being worked on as they push towards their carrier launch. I think it's in November. But this is a Houdini developer model. And I've had the phone for about 2 weeks now, almost 2 weeks. And I love it. It is okay. It's an upgrade from an iPhone 6. So clearly there is speed improvements, bigger size, higher resolution. Everything is bigger and better on this compared to what I was using before. But if I compare it to its contemporaries, it's got the one feature that made me gravitate towards it, a 3D display that does not require any glasses to see. And I gotta say, it came preloaded with a video, and I played that and my jaw dropped. it was just phenomenal.
Really?
It was really, really cool. A few things about it. Number one, I can't put my own images on it because the software to convert images into their proprietary format doesn't exist yet, or at least it's not finalized or public. So I'm just judging based on that bit of cinema and the images that I've been able to take with the phone itself, because it has stereo cameras on the front and back, and they work pretty well. A couple of caveats here in terms of the display tech. Number one, viewing distance has to be a little bit further away than if I'm regular reading text on the phone for it to feel right based on the way the screen is designed. And that's fine. You just have to understand what that distance is. The screen gets slightly lower resolution in terms of 2D when you switch it into 3D because it's translating information into depth. So as a 2D screen, and this should be said, the screen has a 3D mode. In 2D, it's just stellar and a beautiful phone screen.
What kind of resolution is that screen? Do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head. I don't know if they've published the spec to it.
To a Retina type?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. There's no question about that. And then when you go into the 3D mode, it sacrifices some two-dimensional resolution for three-dimensional resolution, and it darkens the screen a little bit in that process. But it's 100% completely usable and viewable as a 3D display. I showed it off at a local camera club, and everybody was just wowed by it. And, I showed somebody a picture just of my daughter on a swing, not even telling them that it was going to be 3D. And they just look at it and they say, wait, what am I seeing here? That doesn't look normal. It's like, it's jumping out at me. It's like, yeah, because it's a 3D display and you didn't have to jump through any hoops to see it.
You said it's got stereoscopic front and back. So you're saying you could take a selfie?
Yes.
That's so, 3D.
Yeah. Now there's, again, some caveats here that I don't know if this was intentional in design, maybe a revision on a future product, or maybe it was just technically not possible. The cameras on the back, they are fairly close together. Maybe, I don't know what that would be.
It's actually a pretty phone, too. It's a nice-looking device.
It is a really nice phone. But they are fairly close in proximity. They are nowhere near what the human pupil distance would be. So if I'm talking about pupil distance, that's the separation, the exact distance between your pupils. And so if they were further apart, then the 3D effect would be more pronounced. But it would mean that there would have to be two separate camera modules on the back of the display or on the back of the phone. And that might interfere with some of the internal ergonomics of where a battery is placed. And then you'd have to make the phone physically larger. And that might not be possible. So I understand the limitations there.
But that's a slight convergence difference, really. That's not anything that can't be overcome in software.
Well, and this is what they're doing in software, is they're computing as if there was more angles to look at. Because if I look at the phone from a different angle, I get to see the subject from a different angle. It's not just 3D, it's holographic. And they're doing this computationally, only with input from two separate sources. So that will create a more dynamic effect. Now, it's interesting to note that it's not the phone detecting that it's moving to create this difference. If the phone is static and I move my head around it will create a different point of view of the same subject, which is really fun technology. The only knock that I have on it, and you mentioned selfies, you've got the two cameras on the front that are like literally right next to each other. What if one of them, say the one that's a little bit more inset, was pushed over to where the proximity sensor is? In that case, I would still have all of the little dots on the top of the phone, but the 3D effect would be more pronounced in selfie mode. I don't know. Maybe there's a reason why it was more efficient to do this. It would maybe drive the cost up. It's already a very expensive phone as it is, but $1,300 for the version that I got.
Well, and so, you need them near, they're both using the same sensor. It's two lenses.
No. Those are separate sensors.
Separate sensors on each one?
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. How is it weight-wise?
It's a tank. But you know what? I like it. Again, I'm coming from a smaller phone. This one is aluminum. They have a titanium version that's supposed to be a little bit heavier even. But the reason why I was kind of against going for an iPhone Plus model for many years is because those are really round edges and smooth surfaces on a big device that I worry I would drop. This phone has little ridges all on the side that match perfectly to my finger's grip. And so that makes it...
Oh, it's actually... indents, like a
actual indents. So some of them have buttons on them, like volume up and down, or the unlock button, which is on the side of the phone as well. But this makes it so hard to drop. I don't fumble with this phone or worry that I'm going to drop it in any way because of the edges on it. That's not a case. That's the phone itself.
You keep calling it a phone, though, so that begs the question, man. First of all, what's the OS? I'm guessing it's Android-based or something. But
Android 8.1 right now.
Then phone-wise, it's pretty good.
Phone-wise, it's great. Absolutely. And I've been porting over from iOS, which is easier to do than I had thought it would be. All of the same apps that I know and love there are here. And you know, simple Google Drive data dump on the iPhone, and then everything just shows up here, which was great. All of my contacts and everything come over pretty simply. And it's just getting kind of used to the larger device and sort of some of the idiosyncrasies, like the way that notifications present themselves, and you know, the fact that, oh, you don't have to use the built-in Messenger app to receive text messages. There's tons of them, and you've got these choices now, and there's a little notification light on the front, and you can specifically program exactly how that works, and it's much more customizable, and I enjoy that about it. So from a new user perspective, I can't speak highly enough for the device. For a technology review of the revolutionary tech that they're putting into this, this is a first run at a glassless 3D display in a phone from Red. It's their first phone at all. In fact, Jim Gennard, the CEO, publicly said, we have no idea what the hell we're doing. And rightly so, they've never done a phone before. So for them to have so many design wins and so much groundbreaking technology in a first push kind of device, I applaud them quite heavily. But this is only the first start of a system. They call it the Red Media Machine. And so what that means is there is a port on the back, there's electrical contacts that will allow you to have modules for cinema quality video and stills attached to the back of the phone. So
it looks like it's a multi-contact, you know, it looks like it's 18, 24 contacts, almost like a docking port.
Exactly. So there's three rows of pins. It's not just like a simple like four contact thing that's going to be kind of a gimmicky add-on. This is going to be a huge push to say, okay, well, you want to have a phone that you can also use as a high-end photography device. Well, keep the phone in your pocket all the time, and you can use the cameras that are on it. They're 12 megapixel cameras. They're great in 2D or 3D. But if you want to add on a cinema quality, impact to that, then you'll have a small camera bag that has those add-ons and accessories. They've said that they'll make a 3D and 2D cinema attachments, as well as a battery. None of those details are fleshed out, and that's subject to change, I'm sure. But the fact, and it's going to cost a lot of money. But the fact that they've made the phone as accessible, it's much cheaper than any of their other hardware devices. I would assume that any attachments onto this won't completely break the bank. And it's a game changer.
You have a developer edition. It's not on the market yet, but do you have a projected, or have they set a projected price point?
Well, you could have pre-ordered it directly from Red, and it was at that time $1,300 or $1,600, depending on the metal it was made of, aluminum or titanium.
Yeah, so it's not that much more than the brand new iPhone.
Yeah, if you get XS Max spec'd out with maximum memory, that's probably going to outprice this phone. So when we've got the high-end devices.
Oh, just brought up memory, though. The XS Max maximum memory is 512. What is this at?
This one has 112.
For storage, we should say, actually.
For storage, 112 gigabytes. And of course, the operating system takes some of that. But it also has a micro SD card. So I've got an extra 128 gigabytes onto that micro SD card as well. Or you can swap out, there's a one tray that has both the SIM card and the micro SD card slot. You can swap that tray out for one that has two SIM cards. So it's your choice. Do you want to have dual SIMs, or do you want to have a SIM card plus a micro SD card?
So it's really, you said something interesting, and you're the geek, so you need to tell me why. Why 112 and not 128?
No, I meant to say 128, but the operating system takes up some space, so that...
Okay, so 112 available, gotcha.
About that, yeah.
Gotcha, all right.
Yeah, so it's new adventures for me, and you get a new phone tomorrow, I think.
Tomorrow, yeah, the Max will... I'm going for the big phone for the first time ever, and I said to somebody, I fully envision I will take it back in within 2 weeks and go back down to the normal XS. But their response to me was, I thought the same thing. And within 3 days, you would have had to pry my Plus out of my cold, dead hand. So yeah. I'm hoping. And
I'm feeling the same way. In fact, when I pick up my old iPhone 6 now, it feels like a toy. It just doesn't feel like I could have ever gotten any joy out of
this one. I mean, because that's about the size. That looks like a Plus, basically.
Fits in my pocket. You know, I'm not wearing like skinny jeans or something. So, you know, it's right. It's going to have the room there. But because it's so solid, like it is a very heavy phone. I didn't expect it to weigh as much as it does. I don't mind the weight. In fact, it makes me get a better grip on it. And I'm not afraid that this thing is going to bend or break in any way.
Interesting. Yeah.
All right. Well, with that out of the way, and anybody who's interested in these phones, you can't view it on YouTube. You have to physically see this to see the magic of the display. If you try to take a picture of it, you don't have any joy. You have to see it in person. So when the carrier launch happens, I think there's going to be a big push where people are going to see it. They're going to walk by it doing some sort of demo reel, and they'll be immediately, you know, roped right into it. Which isn't a bad thing at all. Okay, let's get into the stories of the week. Number one, and this is a topic that that we talked about at some point in an earlier episode, the exact same topic. Photographer Sean R. Heavy or Heavy, I'm not sure how we pronounce his name, has decided to sue Netflix over the use of one of his storm photographs called The Mothership. This image was used in Stranger Things, among other places. And it is a pretty clear use of his work. And so he tried to talk to Netflix, tried to talk to their lawyer. And the lawyer said, no, you know, we're not going to pay you anything. We're not going to settle. Effectively, the lawyer's argument was, and I'm going to quote here, the only similarity that exists between the artwork and Mr. Heavy's photograph, The Mothership, is the use of similar cloud formations. And he continues to say, copyright law, however, does not protect objects as they appear in nature. This is according to the Great Falls Tribune via Petapixel, where we found the article. That's a slap in the face for photographers to say that, okay, well, you photograph some natural object, you don't own the copyright to that natural object, so anybody can take your photo of that natural object and use it willy-nilly. Your thoughts, Steve?
First of all, the other thing that they said, that Netflix said, is they believe that the concept art that he matched, and I think we originally discussed this because it all started, I think, in May of this year. One of the things Netflix said was they're not virtually identical. Well, first of all, in copyright infringements, almost no case I've ever seen has to be virtually identical. I mean, if you're dealing with somebody stealing somebody's song and playing a couple of bars, it doesn't have to be virtually identical. For example, the Vanilla Ice song was not exactly like the Queen song, but they still found an issue with it. I don't buy what they say, first of all, because when you look at the Petapixel post, it's not just a similarity.
It right. is exactly the same storm from exactly the same.
It's image. His photo. Yeah, they're saying it's cloud formations, and it's not cloud formations. It's his photo, for God's sake. And in my opinion, and I'm not an attorney, but I would really love to see an attorney argue this in court. That would be a fun trial to sit in on.
Oh, absolutely.
Because there's just no question in my mind that, nature or not, you could photograph this same cloud formation 17 different ways, process it 20 different ways, and this is Sean's art.
Yeah. Now, it's important to note that if I just take a photo of a gray wall and then try to claim copyright that particular shade of gray and that toneless shift is my artwork, then I'm going to lose, because that is not art. There is no artistic merit involved in a photo of a gray wall. But in this case, he specifically talked about how he made this. This was a panorama with the camera in a vertical orientation.
Four shots.
And it was a four-shot panorama. So there's his vision as an artist into how to capture this. This is not just a simple point and shoot. And I'm sure it was processed and put together in a seamless way that illustrates his skill as an artist, as a photographer who's also an artist. And so I don't think that there's any debate there. However, there might be a debate as to how transformative this is, which then could result in a fair use kind of battle. Not to say that the photographer would lose that battle, but then it would become a battle for fair use. And I actually talked to my attorney. I wanted her opinion on this, because I'm not a lawyer either, but I did want to kind of get a feel for what a lawyer might think of this. And she's allowed me to kind of quote her on some of the thoughts about this. So, you know, she says that, first of all, this didn't strike me at all until she mentioned it. And I was thinking, well, duh, Netflix didn't produce Stranger Things. 21 Labs Entertainment produced Stranger Things. They are the production company. And so if anybody willingly infringed on his work, then it wouldn't be Netflix. It would be 21 Labs Entertainment.
That's a good point.
Why aren't they named on this suit? Because that would be a more logical approach to go to.
Well, yeah, or both. I mean, well, exactly. I would name the distribution channel as well. You know, before you read what she says, let's also get in there something in Sean's favor here. The way he describes taking this shot was, you know, that he put great effort into it, right? It's the four shot pano, vertical pano. He hunted the storm for hours. And let's also get out there, this was from 2010, the image, and it was registered timely with the U.S. Copyright Office in 2010. And since they used it, he has found it also used in a TV show called How It Ends. So part of his claim is that there is further copying because of this.
And I mean, good on him for registering the copyright, number one. PSA, register the copyright to your images. If you need to find out why, just or how, just Google it and you'll find a bunch of very easy tutorials, even if you're not a citizen of the United States, to register your copyright with the U.S. Copyright Office. Number two, why wouldn't you register the copyright on this gorgeous image? I mean, it was worth all of the effort that he put into it. This is one of the most beautiful storm photographs I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
So my compliments to Sean for creating this particular image. And I mean, it's sad that it's infringed upon, but Leslie Burns, my attorney, and she can be found at burnstheattorney.com. She's awesome, by the way. I love working with her on you know, my own copyright issues. But she says that generally speaking, photos of nature can be accorded what is called, quote, thin copyright, sometimes because the subject is just simply what it is, and there is little creativity involved in capturing it. So the quote from the Great Falls paper about a cloud not being copyrightable is disingenuous. The cloud isn't, but the photograph that captures a cloud, especially in an innovative manner, certainly is. And here the photographer apparently created the image out of several frames in a highly unusual natural subject, so I don't think that'll be a big problem for him. That is, this won't get kicked out of court for lack of creativity. So we've discussed that, and Leslie definitely agrees from a creativity standpoint that this is a very creative image. It's not just a simple snapshot. However, she continues, I think it could be a closest call on the issue of inspiration versus copying. There is a lot that could go south here for the photographer because the uses aren't a straight up exact copy of the original, particularly the How It Ends film one. That one scene with the rolling clouds was very likely inspired by the photographer's work, but it is very likely legally transformative. And she says in parentheses that she does not use that word lightly. Even the concept art uses might be seen as permissible. There is at least some case law that tends towards permitting concept use under fair use. Overall, this will likely end up as a fair use battle, and those can be costly. I hope it goes well for the photographer, because it's very clear, or pretty clear, she says, that his work was used. The question is whether it was legally permissible. So, legally permissible is what it kind of boils down to, whether or not Netflix could find some angle to argue the argument that they've stated, you know, that was quoted in this article. Definitely doesn't fly for me, and I don't think that it would fly for anybody, but there might be some other legally permissible angle for them to approach it, and that sucks.
Well, and something else should be tossed in here, and And what's interesting about it is it's the same show, Stranger Things. And we talked about, why are they not going after the production company? Why are they going after the distribution channel of Netflix? But in a very eerily similar scenario, there was a photographer who had a photograph of a VHS tape that was used in a Stranger Things cover art.
I think it was their collector's box set or something.
Collector's box set. And they settled on that one. The photographer sued them, and they settled. So it's been done before that somebody has sued Netflix over the use of a photo in relation to Stranger Things and ended up with a settlement. And I don't doubt that that could happen here with a reasonable price. What's funny is the Petapixel article shows a survey. And they surveyed, you know, Petapixel readers, right? So you're thinking photographers, 65% of 21,000 plus in a poll thought that the photographer deserved to be paid. And what strikes me about that is Petapixel is a photography-based site.
I would have expected that to be 80 plus.
And 35% of the people reading Petapixel or doing this poll think he does not deserve to get paid. And that is shocking to me.
Well, 11.45% as I'm looking at it right now say maybe, but still, it's a shocking number.
Yeah.
And here I am as a photographer who battles with copyright on a regular basis. Steve, you and I have had some private discussions about some of the infringements that I have found. But with my copyright infringement cases, they've appeared on everything from decals and being sold as artwork to clothing and being used as branding for different companies. And there's two or three prominent images. And yes, I have the copyright to those images registered with the U.S. Copyright Office. One of them definitely with the Canadian Intellectual Property Office. And I try to defend my work, but sometimes it's just impossible to do so. Or because if the infringer is in Nepal or Russia, it's quite a difficult challenge. By the way, if anybody knows listening to this podcast, a copyright lawyer in Paraguay, please let me know their contact information. I would appreciate that. But at the end of the day, it comes down to a battle of rights for photographers. And this is clearly part of that battle. Steve, I know that you've had some of your images infringed upon in the past, but you can't necessarily go after them as well. And we shouldn't necessarily name names, but In the case of your concert photography imagery, if theoretically a band or a marketing company or a record label decided to use one of your images without permission, then not only would you never be able to shoot that band again out of some sort of falsely placed retribution, but anybody associated with that record label would probably give you a no-show. It's like, you can't come here. You can't take pictures of us anymore, ever. Blanket ban for life. And that puts you in a tough place because, you know, you have to defend your rights just the same as every other photographer does. So that sucks for you, I guess.
Yeah. And you know, that's always a judgment call. You know, one thing that I find interesting that people really need to think about is you mentioned as somebody who lives in Canada one of your images was registered that's infringed a lot with the Canadian copyright system, but that you also copyrighted it in the US because if an image is going to be infringed, there is a large possibility that it will be infringed by a US company or within the US. Anybody can register in the US and I register my images before I post them. So if I do a shoot on a Saturday night and I'm going to post the blog post or give to a client the images, you know, Sunday or Monday, part of the half hour that I do before I submit those pictures is I register that shoot every time before anybody sees any photos now. And for me, it's always a judgment call, right? Depending on the use, both who used it and how, is that the hill I want to die on? You know, for example, one of mine was a magazine overseas. They used the image. They used two of my images. They took my watermark off. I was going to go after the magazine. Well, the band that was involved in that photo or the artist shared that magazine's post on their site in the US, which means technically I could have gone after him. And what I said to the attorney was, I'm not going to go after that band. I'll never be able to shoot them again. And they were just sharing someone else's work. But here's the thing. if a record label used your image as a band, you know, music photography image in a commercial way, they have every reason to expect that somebody would go after them. And generally there would not be retribution if it was very clear that, oh man, we used this on an album cover. We shouldn't have done that. And it's going to get, you know, dealt with. Yeah. So I wouldn't worry about it, but there is always that issue you have to worry about. If you go after a management company for band A and they represent 20 bands and you make them mad, you may never shoot the other 19.
Yeah. Well, and I also should say that, try not to handle this stuff yourself. Get a good lawyer. And I've got great lawyers in Canada, the US. I use Image Rights International for a lot of my international claims. And so cases in Italy or wherever, they don't have an attorney in Paraguay. But I had one case recently where a cryptocurrency was using one of my images, my Maple Leaf flag photograph. And I couldn't find any contact information for them. And so it wasn't viable for a lawyer to take on contingency. So what am I going to do at that point? I just find a contact at somebody in charge of this particular cryptocurrency. And it's not Bitcoin or Litecoin or Ethereum. It's something else. It's not one of those that you've likely heard of. But I send the guy an invoice. I mean, he's using it prominently on their website as an icon in a permanent usage place. And I just send him an invoice. It's like, oh, by the way, you're using my photograph. Please stop using that one because I use that for my own personal branding. And here's an invoice for retroactive usage. And his response was arrogant. And I mean, politely arrogant, though. He said, yeah, well, we'll take it down. Thanks for letting you know, or letting us know. And I said, okay, well, here's a PayPal link to pay the invoice. And he said, no, we're not going to pay that. It's not going to happen. So if I had an attorney, if I had a physical mailing address, which is one of the things I was missing, if this cryptocurrency was linked to an actual registered corporation and I have evidence of that, then that would have been viable for lawyers to go after. But I just, you know, sent a simple letter and they took it down, but I'm never going to see any money from that. And that, it bothers me. That's the kind of stuff that keeps me up at night. So the lawyers, they handle that much better than any individual can.
You definitely need to revisit this story, though, when there is either a settlement or a verdict.
We will. We will absolutely revisit this. Copyright is, it's kind of a boring thing to talk about, but it does tug on the heartstrings a little bit when people steal your stuff.
And you know what it is? I think a lot of people really, everybody on the internet is a lawyer. And so in all the forums, you literally see stuff that is, you know, an advice, as it were, that is quite often completely inaccurate, not even slightly. So a lot of people are confused and don't understand it, and it makes their head spin. But the key is register your work. That really is the keys to enforcement. Yes, you own copyright the minute you click the picture. But if they refuse to pay you and you want to go to court without a registration, you may have difficulty getting a lawyer.
Well, I mean, if the usage is such that actual damages is going to be a big number rather than statutory damages, then you might still get a lawyer interested. But it's always better to have that registration. It's it's a great tool and not very expensive. What's it, $50 US?
$55 US. And they've, as of February, they changed it. In fact, I'm going to do a new show with the Copyright Zone guys coming up here on my podcast. It's $55 in the US, and now you're limited to 750 photos per registration.
I think that's still fine. And the fact that they require you to identify every image in the registration with an Excel spreadsheet and a file name saying, you know, when it was taken, et cetera, that only helps you. It is a little bit more burdensome for the registration process, but in the end, you are better for it if any of those images get infringed.
Yep.
Okay. We'll save that for Ed Greenberg, who is from the Copyright Zone. He's the lawyer with Jack Riznicki, which are a great duo to have on. And I look forward to hearing that episode whenever you get around to it.
Yeah. And people should see anything those two talk about just because they're so fun.
They're fun. Lots of energy there. Okay. Let's switch from stealing photographs to possibly losing them, and storage and all of the stuff that photographers need to be aware of in terms of where we keep our images, how we keep them safe. Seagate has just announced a 14 terabyte hard drive, their Iron Wolf and their Iron Wolf Pro, which they also have an Exos for their data center stuff that has a 14 terabyte capacity as well. But a single spinning disk hard drive with a capacity of 14 terabytes. This is on the heels of, I mean, their previous one was 12 terabytes, so this is just a logical increase. What do you think about, because I know, Steve, you work in IT. What do you think about putting that much data on one device that has moving parts?
You know, okay. Depending on the use, again, these are NAS drives, right? So these are not something you're gonna generally at least put in a custom built desktop that you're gonna do. These are for NAS situations.
Network, so you've NAS got storage, so you're
Synology or you know, something of that effect, where you're gonna have a multi-bay drive and you're gonna be running something, either a proprietary RAID for the device like a Drobo or a Synology RAID, or you're gonna be running more of a standard RAID 1, RAID 0, RAID 5, RAID 6, RAID 10, whatever it is. And if you're using a NAS or if you're using some type of network attached storage, you need to have a backup plan anyway. But usually in many, many situations, there is a huge amount of data. And what that creates is the requirement that you buy very, very large RAID arrays with 24 bays, 48 bays, expandable
Mine has 12,
bays.
You know, and so I've got a bunch of 8 terabyte drives in my Synology NAS. And, you know, it's the Western Digital Red Pro. I've always used
Which Western. Is Red is the NAS version of the Western Digital.
Exactly. And they have the regular and the Pro version, which has some vibration sensors, which in larger arrays will help things from falling apart, because it's amazing how much vibration you can have when you've got all of these spinning disks at 7,200 RPM stacked on top of each other in the same structure. So there's some mitigations on their Pro.
But think about this with these, and here's the advantage to the 14, is now you can get that storage in a 4-bay.
Exactly. Array.
So you don't have to buy a large space consuming RAID array to get the storage out of 8 terabyte drives. You can put 14 terabyte drives in a smaller array as long as you buy the right drive. So the Iron Wolf and the Iron Wolf Pro have some very, very distinct differences. For example, the Iron Wolf only supports, or is recommended for, I wasn't clear on that from their documentation, a multi-drive 8-bay max.
Yeah.
Whereas the Pro supports up to 24.
Right. And their Exos drives, they say unlimited, you know, a million, whatever.
Yeah.
Please buy a million drives from us. But, you know, the idea is moving parts fail, right? And so that's why RAID arrays, RAID 5 has a single disk redundancy. RAID 6 has a dual disk redundancy.
Correct.
And I've got a RAID 5 array right now, but if one drive fails, I also have a drive in reserve that is just in the unit waiting to replace a drive that fails automatically.
Otherwise known as a hot spare.
Exactly, a hot spare. I look at
now,
this.
Be aware though, I want to interject here, and I apologize interrupting you, but this is really important that people understand, because you and I both see this all the time, where I see photographers, I've got a backup because all my data is on my RAID.
No.
RAID is not a backup, number one. Okay. RAID is hardware redundancy, so that if a single drive or whatever fails,
fire, flood, theft ain't going to stop your data from disappearing.
Exactly.
Right?
Or more to the point, your NAS RAID device itself is still a single point of failure. If the board goes out on your RAID device, unless it has redundant controllers, you're still going to lose the device, and that's an electronic board. But more than that is what people think, well, I have the hot spare, so if a drive dies, boom, I'm covered, I've got a hot spare. And that's not totally true, because what happens is, if you've got an 8-drive array, one of those drives stores parity information. So you really only get usable storage for 7 of those drives. If one of those drives dies, there is a rebuild time. As the new hot spare comes online, the redundancy information or parity information has to be regenerated. And depending on the size of the array, that could take 24 hours. During that time, that window, it's small, but you had one drive die in that array. If a second drive dies within that window, your data is gone. So not a backup.
Exactly. And especially if the data die or if the drive dies during a rebuild. I mean, sometimes if a drive fails or it's being read as a failure, you might be able to resurrect it, at least temporarily, with software like SpinWrite, which does some miraculous stuff in certain scenarios. But if you're actively trying to rebuild an array, I don't think that would save you because things are in a level of chaos at that point, which is where RAID 6 makes more sense, where you have a dual disk redundancy with a hot spare so that if one disk were to fail and you want to cover your bases for that the rebuild time, if a second disk fails during the rebuild, you are still okay. Now, the pressure is on to completely rebuild the array at that point, although the possibility of that much of a cascade failure happening all at once becomes like winning the lottery.
Yes, but, you know, again, my favorite RAID experience was actually a server that had two RAID systems in it, RAID 5 for the data partitions and logical drives, and then a RAID 1, which is a mirror, for the boot partition on an old Windows server. I mean, this was back probably Windows NT4. But the main drive on the boot partition had a master boot record failure. The RAID controller mirrored that.
Oh, lovely.
To the second drive in the mirror. So where normally if the first drive failed, you could simply reboot to the copy mirrored drive. The mirror drive was also corrupted.
Now, so again, a master boot record is a recoverable error. That's just some bits went wrong and they can be put back into place in most cases.
In a RAID situation, though, it can be dangerous to try and rebuild a master boot record at times. You can end up with other problems from that.
Lovely. Okay, so our world is chaos.
Yeah. So the bottom line is, though, with these drives, here's the thing. I know you always like, what's the thing people don't talk about? And here's the thing people don't talk about. The regular to the pro, the regular is 100 million hours mean time between failure. It's 1.2 million hours.
I found that suspicious. It's like it's the same hardware. Something just didn't pass muster. So they put a cheaper price tag on it and say that it doesn't pass the same threshold.
Well, and it's a warranty difference, right? So 5 years for the pro, 3 for the regular. It's a workload difference, 300 terabytes a year for the pro workload, only 180 for the regular. And yet, so think about that, right? You get 0.2 million more hours, 2 more years warranty, and almost double the workload. And it's only $70 more.
It makes me feel like the regular Iron Wolf ones are just rejects that would otherwise,
right?
Just, you know, like, well, we can't sell this. But so looking at these two items, I would not buy the regular Iron Wolf. I would definitely go with the Iron Wolf
$70.
Pro. It's a $70 difference. And so, you know, you look at the, what is the price point? I looked them up on B&H and they're selling for like,
it's $530 for the regular, about $600 for the pro. Oh, and that's right. I almost forgot. On the regular for $530, if you want to, as an additional option, you can add data recovery services, rescue services. But on the pro, for that extra $70, you not only get the warranty and the better workload and the meantime between failure increase and 24 bays instead of 8, you get data rescue services included.
I just find that suspicious as well. I mean, I don't want that included. I mean, yes, sure. If I call them up and say that my drive has failed, I would like them to handle that for free. I don't want that to be a marketing point because that just means that enough of your drives do fail that you have a whole department that you're very proud of that can recover them. That should not be the case.
Yeah. And again, the prices are for the differences in specs and intended use model. The prices are suspiciously close to each other.
B&H has the Pro at about $560, $570, so a little bit lower than MSRP. Yeah, I'd go for that. But I've always bought Western Digital drives, and in their enterprise class drives, they go up to 12 terabytes. I'm sure a 14 terabyte drive is in their future. What's your opinion between those two brands?
I don't use Seagate drives, and nothing personal against Seagate. I've just have had not over the years, not as good of a reliability experience as I do with the Western Digital. The Western Digital Caviar drives, the blacks, super fast, the green, low power, the red is NAS. What's the blue? Regular?
Normal? I don't know. And gold is their enterprise NAS.
And gold is enterprise. The main thing is buy the drive that fits your need. So if you're populating a Synology RAID or a Drobo, buy drives intended for a NAS, because unlike your computer that you shut down, that usually is running 24 hours a day. It's network attached. It has different performance specs, and you want the right drive for the use.
Exactly. And I have a safety deposit box that has a portable USB hard drive. I think it's a 3 or 4 terabyte drive that has all of my important financial documents, you know, all, you know, tax records, all of my completed images, all of like my master TIFF files of everything. That is just in a safety deposit box, just in case everything else fails. I'm not out of that. So there are many ways for you to keep your data secure. And the cost of that one little extra security measure, that's what, $50 a year for renting the box? And
yeah, mine is probably $70 a year for my safe deposit box.
Yeah.
It depends on the size of the box you get.
I mean, if your work is that important and you're making a business out of photography, or you just value the work that you do with your camera, at least do something beyond just having them in one place. All right. Yeah. That said, and I'm glad I have you on to discuss that, because, you know, when we see these drives going up to 14 terabytes, I worry that a photographer would say, yeah, that's perfect. I'm just going to throw everything on there and just going to have that as a main drive. I can put my entire archives in there all in one place and I'm happy, until it's no longer there.
And yet that same photographer, I know so many I won't use a, you know, 128 gigabyte CF card because I don't want all my pictures on one card. And yet they would do that. So yeah, just bottom line is just be logical. Think to yourself how many points of failure there are in any given scenario and mitigate as many as you can.
Exactly. All right. Let's go to something a little bit otherworldly, shall we? Let's jump over to another article from Petapixel. This one is titled SpaceX's First Space Tourist Will Pick a Photographer for a Free Moon Trip. And that is slightly misleading because the Japanese billionaire Yusaku Maezawa, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who is has been revealed by SpaceX and Elon Musk as being the purchaser of a trip around the moon, is going to bring between 6 and 8 artistic people with him. And of these artistic people, there is a list of possibilities of a film director, painter, dancer, novelist, musician, fashion designer, sculptor, photographer, and architect that will accompany him on a 5-day trip around the moon and back to Earth. They don't get to go on the moon, but at least you get to see the dark side of it, which half the time is light, but that's neither here nor there. I can't see, Steve, a dancer or a fashion designer really getting a good pull from this kind of a journey. But a painter, photographer, sculptor, architect, all of these can be greatly and profoundly influenced by a trip around the moon. My question.
See, that's funny, because I was going to say the architect I didn't see.
Well, you know, I'd like some moon inspired architecture. I don't even know what that means, but it just sounds interesting.
Yeah, it does sound interesting. The painter, I could actually see the painter, the dancer. I'm just not getting, except for the fact that they'd be in zero gravity, you know, and maybe they could really do some really cool dance steps in zero gravity.
I would say if Cher gets her dance moves on, you know,
you're Canadian. You could have gone Celine Dion.
No, well, I'm not a huge fan, to be honest.
Okay.
But anyhow, so question number one, Steve, if you were miraculously chosen as the photographer to go on this trip, would you go?
Okay, so I have to be careful here. I'm not supposed to say anything yet. Wouldn't that be awesome, though? If literally I just went, you know, he called yesterday. If I were to go, would I go? Yeah, I think I would. I would not go without thinking I could die.
Yeah. And right? I mean, I've got a wife and daughter here too. So, I mean, I'm a huge support for them. I don't want to leave them without a husband or a father.
See, and that's the thing. But if I were, you know, it's kind of like jumping out of a plane, right? When I was young, would I have gone parachuting? Yeah, I would have done it in a second. Once I had a child, that went out the window. I can't do that. Now that my child is off on his own, you know, I still see it as family. And so it would be tougher. But would I consider it seriously? Oh, yes, I would consider it seriously. And by the way, this ship, the name alone of the ship that he's basically purchased, you know, he's rented the ship for the trip, is the BFR, or Big...
Well, the Big Falcon Rocket, not the Doom reference to the BFG.
No, no, but but they actually call it Big Blanking Rocket. It has a capacity of 100 passengers. And he's going to take, you know, 6 to 8 artists. And by the way, the project is hashtag Dear Moon, which I love that, actually. But the flight could be as early as 2023. And I had a question for you when I saw this. Because the guy actually, he put out a quote. He said, if you hear from me, please say yes and accept my invitation. Please do not say no. So, okay, now I have to say yes if he calls. But do you really see this getting off the ground by 2023? That's 4 years.
They don't have a, I mean, we're seeing renderings of what it's going to look like, and that may change, but they don't have a functional device right now. It's partly off the drawing board, I'm sure. But I don't know how far along it is for them to say 2023 is actually viable. There's going to have to be test runs, and we haven't seen any tests of anything here yet. And I know how long this type of stuff does take to develop. So I'd say 2025, 2026 would probably be a better bet.
I'm thinking 2025, 2026, because I sure wouldn't get on it unless I saw them launch one or two, because they had some issues at first just landing on that barge. But let's be honest, this is a group of people who have managed to send a rocket into space and have it come back down and land on a barge. If anybody can do it, SpaceX is on the track. Absolutely. I don't see that time frame.
Yeah, well, I mean, next year they're going to be doing their deliveries to the International Space Station, their personnel, I don't know what they call it, but to deliver the astronauts to the ISS. And that is delayed considerably. It was supposed to be out now. So who knows? Elon Musk is a busy guy. He's got Tesla. He's got the Boring Company. He's got SpaceX.
Right. And Twitter. use, not in ownership, but in use. Yeah.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so you think about all this and where his attentions lie. I mean, he is the Tony Stark of our real world. And right? I know this is going to happen. The fact that it's just, it might take more time than he's saying, that doesn't bother me at all. The fact that it's going to happen just tickles me. It's just fantastic.
Name something. I mean, I remember when he first announced, I'm going to create a power wall. And everybody kind of went, really, you know, battery technology, I don't, he now has a power wall. If Elon says he's going to do something, like you say, I mean, really, it sounds so amazing, but really he is, you know, Tony Stark incarnate.
Yep. And you see where this is going though, don't you? Because if this vehicle in its initial inaugural flight takes a handful of people, but it can be reused, and they can eventually build a fleet of these that will fly people around the moon as a tour. It's within our lifetime that the cost of doing so is something that you can scratch off your bucket list.
Right, right.
And so, well, you might not be the first civilian, you know, a photographer just off the street to go and take photos from the other side of the moon looking back at the Earth. I've got the feeling that I might start saving my pennies now, because before I die, that is something that I can do. And that just makes me so excited.
Yeah, from a creative point of view.
Well, not even that, because, I mean, I've taken photos of the moon from this side, as has every other photographer ever. Right. Does that make my photos unique? Not at all. But it would be mine. you know, to say that I went on that journey and this is a memento of that. Just like photographing an eclipse. How many people take pictures of the eclipse? Yeah, I still want my own. It's not artistic, really,
right,
at that point, especially when it's such a rinse and repeatable process at that time.
It's bucket listable, yeah.
It's a bucket listable thing. I mean, how many photos have we seen from Antelope Canyon or Horseshoe Bend or name your famous photographic location that are almost indistinguishable from each other because it's the exact same location photographed with the same camera and lens, just by a different person. Well, exactly. Yeah. So I don't think that it will, that its uniqueness will last. Hey, I think that eventually I want to go there. I think that'll be fun.
I agree.
All right. Let's wrap up the stories with our fourth story. This one comes from mirrorlessrumors.com. And this is what they claim to be a 100% accurate sketch of the Fuji GFX-50R that I'm sure we will be getting all of the pertinent details right before Photokina, as most of these things happen to come out. This is a cheaper version of the 50 megapixel medium format camera that Fuji has released. It was last year, I think, or the year before, but a totally brand new system that Fuji hit the ground floor for medium format of in terms of price point, but not necessarily in terms of features. It was a pretty full featured device. And now they're dropping that floor even lower. The proposed price, or the rumored price here, is said to be around $4,500 US. And to me, that catches my attention because I look at a camera. We don't really have any specs, and honestly, we don't need to. The fact is that we are going to have a less expensive medium format camera compared to the last time you were on, Steve. We talked about $50,000 medium format cameras, and arguably, right, you know, Phase One has a different market. Their medium format sensors are larger than the Fuji ones. But at $4,500, if you are a photographer considering upgrading to a new system, or just, you know, you've had your camera for forever and you want to get something new, or you have a little bit of money saved up and you want to get your first serious camera, does a price point at $4,500 make a lot of sense for them to draw in a crowd?
I suppose it depends on what you're shooting, right? I mean, medium format, there's a lot of people who want medium format that don't really need medium format.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't use medium format for what I shoot. Now, if I was shooting fashion, or if I was shooting something that was going to be on a billboard, or high-end commercial stuff, okay, maybe. If I was doing wedding portraiture, okay, maybe. I probably wouldn't use nowadays with the high megapixel Nikons that we have, and Canons that we have, and Sonys that we have. I just you know, where Panasonic is with the mirrorless, I don't know that for a wedding, unless it was the portrait side of it, that I would during a ceremony use one either. However, for $4,500, it would be a really cool tool to have in the bag, because think about what, like you said, what mirrorless, medium format costs. Yeah, we talked about the crazy expensive ones, but a normal medium format, you're talking 10 grand.
Yeah.
This is a really good deal. Now, what do you get for that though? For $4,500, it's 50 megapixels. We know that. It's going to be an EVF. It is a tiltable screen on two axes. So that's interesting. The SD cards, there will be two SD cards, which is going to be interesting. You're going to have some really fast SD cards to write twice at the same time, same image, if you're doing them, you know, mirrored, that higher resolution picture fast enough. What's fascinating to me, the thing that stuck out to me was, in my head, I have a look of a medium format camera.
Right. And this does not look like it at all. This looks like a pocket camera.
A standard small format. I don't want to say point and shoot, but you know, interchangeable lens, just normal $300 camera with an interchangeable lens. It's really interesting because, you know, normally medium format, you picture it being having depth and having a back. This is interesting.
Well, of course, because it's mirrorless, you don't need to have an optical viewfinder, and the bigger the sensor, the bigger the mirror would have to be, and thereby the physical camera size would have to be much larger. And that I think is a deterrent for a lot of people that want to get into the medium format world. What I want to see Fuji come up with while this camera is great and having a nice low-end product would be fascinating, they are poised, I think, to do something that the Canon and Nikons and Sonys of the world might not be able to do. They'd need the sensor for it, but what if you could do a 20 megapixel medium format camera, but those pixels would be sizably larger, noticeably larger than a full frame camera at 20 megapixels. And thereby, especially with a newer generation of technology, you could make a camera that could virtually see in the dark. I know Canon has teased some sensors, and they've got some industrial cameras that use some incredible technology, especially I think it's only monochrome technology, but to go up to like almost ISO a million. But if the sensor could be physically larger, then those limits could be pushed because each photo site on the sensor would have a larger area to collect light from. So,
and that's the key, by the way, when you're talking low light, is you want each photo site to be larger with proper gapping in between those photo sites to prevent crosstalk. So imagine a medium format camera that does extreme low light, and as long as we're building our own camera here, and does video.
Well, okay, then if you're going that far, if you want to make that as primarily a video camera, then make it an 8 megapixel sensor that shoots 4K, pixel for pixel.
Yeah, on a medium format sensor.
On a medium format size. I mean, there's a lot of potential.
You'd make it 8K if you had that much, but still.
Well, sure. But what I'm saying is that Fuji has the potential to do something that their competitors can't do by the virtue of having that larger sensor. And they're putting a lot of R&D into all of this stuff. I don't think Fuji makes their own sensors, so they'd have to depend on Sony or somebody else to actually develop that technology for them, at which point Sony doesn't care because they're still making money off of the sensors anyhow.
Right. Well, and this article hints, it would be really cool if they got the price closer to $4,000 instead of $4,500. First of all, if this is what you're looking for, $500 isn't. If you're going to buy a $4,000 camera, $4,500 isn't a huge difference. But secondly, if this is a medium format 50 megapixel camera in the form factor that I'm seeing here, $4,500 is a steal.
Oh yeah, and there's no knowledge of whether or not it comes with a lens. One assumed that there would be some sort of a kit lens, but you don't know. So we'll just kind of leave this one as a rumor for now, but I wanted to bring it up to discuss the possibilities that would create for Fuji, because I mean, they're rocking it in the APS-C world, and their medium format stuff is interesting. And so just to see the evolution of this technology, it's really interesting just to keep my finger on the pulse of it.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Cool. Well, let's wind down here. Another great episode of Photo Geek Weekly. I want to remind people, Steve, your podcast, Behind the Shot, can be found at behindtheshot.tv, correct?
Correct. Behindtheshot.tv.
And how many episodes have you got out since you relaunched?
Well, since I relaunched, I've probably done, I don't know, 5 or 6 or so. I'm recording episode 50 on this coming Monday after we're recording this. And because I release twice a month, so it's taken a while. And I took a 2-3 month break off when I left my previous network and went out on my own to kind of revamp it. But I release bi-monthly. All the subscribe links are at behindtheshot.tv. The old feed from the network is still there. So if you just search for Behind the Shot in your podcast catching app, make sure you get one of the ones with the new logo that says my name on it. There's an audio and a video feed. And that way you'll get new episodes because none of the shows will show up in the old feed. We just got some really cool stuff.
Yeah, I enjoy listening and watching too. It's helpful to see the image when people are talking about it. But I want people to do you a favor. Anybody listening to this that enjoys this podcast and hopefully Steve's podcast, if you enjoy his podcast, write a review and give him some good love there, because I want more and more people to discover the Behind the Shot podcast. And while you're there, write a nice review for me too. Why not?
And people don't realize the reviews are nice. I love getting the reviews. And yeah, if people could drop a review and a rating in iTunes or wherever you're at, it's available on Spotify and all that. But what the reviews do for people like you and I is it helps with discoverability. So that helps, Apple, for example, and iTunes decide where to position it in search results. So all of that matters. So yes, if you would drop a review, that would be great. And thank you for bringing that up. You have no idea.
No worries. I know the value of that. And we've got a captive audience here for at least a little while longer. So why don't we dive into our picks of the week?
Okay.
Steve, I know that you said that you might have a pick and possibly a tip. So pick one of them to start with, then I'll do mine and you round off the last one.
Okay. So I'm going to do my pick of the week. My pick of the week is a new book that's out and it's from a friend of mine and somebody that I actually consider to be one of the best live music photographers on the planet. She is the house photographer for the Royal Albert Hall, as in the hall that's mentioned in the Beatles songs in London. Her name is Christy Goodwin. And Christy is not only the house photographer there, but a well-known photographer for a number of artists as far as touring. She's toured with Taylor Swift. She's toured with Joe Bonamassa. She does book covers, a bunch of other things. But the other thing that's interesting about Christy is she was one of the first real live music photographers to photograph Ed Sheeran when he was in basically a pub in an upstairs room with 20 people in the audience. And she was there to photograph that. And she has been photographing Ed Sheeran for 10 years now over his career. She's released a new book called Memories We Made. And it's available through her website. All the links are on her website. It is already out in the UK. It's coming out in other countries. The launch in the US is November 6th, but you can pre-order it on Amazon. And I think it's a number one bestseller right now on Amazon. And I managed to get the US copy. Will have a different photo on the cover, I believe is the main difference. There might be other differences. And I am getting one of those. I have a US copy on pre-order, but I managed to get a UK copy. And I thought, and this is part of the reason I'm picking it, not only because I know Christy and I love her work. She really is, honestly, I'm not kidding, one of my favorite photographers. I thought it was a coffee table photo book with you open it and it's photos. I didn't realize it's a story from beginning to end of her 10 years photographing him. The foreword of the book is written by Ed's dad.
Wow.
And him talking about this is a great book, and it really is neat to see the evolution of Ed's career and Christie's career shooting Ed. And then periodically throughout the book, John Sheeran will chime in, the dad will chime in with a little snippet about this is one of my favorite shots from this show and this is why. And Christy on each of the shows that she shot him does a 1 or 2 page summary of that event.
I love that. And I don't want to buy a book that is just a fluff piece. I want to dive into it. I want the details. I want the narrative. And the photos can sometimes carry that. But if you write the narrative, the stuff that couldn't be photographed or the struggle to get the image or just the fun or the tragedy or whatever the scenario happened to bring about. And if you're telling me that this book has that, then it's one that I'll pick up too.
It's seriously, I read the foreword and then I read her introduction. And I'm up to out of 200 and whatever pages, 289 pages or 69 pages. I'm at page 90 or something right now. And the story of her first event photographing Ed, I don't want to give it away, but let's just say shortly into his set, the power went out. And she figured it was over, but it wasn't over. And the whole book is stories like that. I mean, that's the perfect teaser, and I don't want to spoil what happened. But really, again, it's Christy Goodwin. It's called Memories We Made, and it's about Ed Sheeran. And it really, I kid you not, it is just an amazing book.
And we will have the link to where you can get that at photogeekweekly.com in the show notes for this episode. That's a great pick. Thank you very much, Steve. Another one, it's something that we actually covered on a previous episode. I think Alan Attridge was the guest host on the episode where I talked about a story of a photographer that made a modification to a lens, a Zenitar 50mm f2 lens in, I don't know what mount it's available in. The one that I got is an M42 thread mount. And the trick is, if you take this lens, first of all, you got to remove the rear element, and you can do that. I used a screwdriver and a hammer to just loosen up the little tightening thing on the back, although a set of calipers would probably be the right tool for that. I'm never going to pass up an opportunity to take a hammer to a lens, though. So you take out the rear element.
Oh, my God.
And then if you shake it semi-vigorously, some baffling inside of that will further fall out that was holding in place an internal lens group. If you put that lens group in place backwards and then put the whole thing back together, it creates like a beautiful monster, like soap bubble bokeh effect that people spend like over $1,000 on some lenses. Like the Trioplan 100 is a famous lens from Meyer Optic that had this wonderful soap bubble bokeh. And you can get a very similar effect for $35 plus shipping on eBay. It's got to come from Eastern Europe. So, I mean, I see shipping prices around $15 here for me in Canada. So about a $50 investment to get it to your door. And yeah, you might break it if you're trying to take it apart and put it back together. That's part of the thrill, I guess. And then you might waste $50. At least you're not wasting $500. It is really cool. I bought it on a whim, saying, hey, you know, let's just see what this how this works. And with the modification, you get some pretty spectacular out-of-focus details on any specular highlights that you have in the image. The caveat is that the in-focus areas where it passes through the focal plane, it gets kind of distorted and muffled, and it's not as clear as if you were to have spent, you know, multiple hundreds of dollars on a lens known for that same kind of bokeh. So there's a compromise there.
I'm confused on something. When you open a lens and the lens elements are in there, right?
Yeah.
Multiple lens elements. Let's call it five. They're in slots.
Not
the slots
exactly.
Are sized in such a way that you can reverse their positioning and they fit.
So the rear element is held in place by what amounts to like a filter ring. You know, the glass filter for the front of your lens has these, some of them do anyhow, these two little tiny little notches in them. And you can use a set of calipers to loosen that and take the glass out of the ring.
Okay.
And so it's the exact same technology holding the rear element in place. So you can remove that little screwed on piece and then the rear element falls out. Now, this is not a very expensive lens. I mean, it's designed poorly compared to modern standard equipment. So you don't have to disassemble the entire body of the lens. You just take off the rear element and then there's just a smaller tube inside that is holding an internal lens group away from that rear element. And so if you shake it enough, that internal tube that's of a smaller diameter will just fall out, taking the internal lens group with it. And then you just flip that around, put it all back in, otherwise normal, and you get something that is quite spectacularly unique. Now, is it artistic? Yes, it's absolutely artistic. Is it accurate to reality? No, but that's not why you're going to be using a lens like this to begin with. You're just trying to mess around with light. You're just going to bend it and twist it, you know, embracing the whole lomography world on your regular camera. I was playing around with the Lumix GX9 with this lens on it, and it even functions well with a small amount of extensions if you want to shift it even closer into a macro world. The closer you focus, the more interesting the bokeh in the background gets. So I have it on my list within the next couple of days to do some serious tinkering. And I did some initial tests. They were phenomenal. That's why this is my pick of the week. And I'll put a link in the show notes to where you can find it on eBay. I found a link when they've got seven available there. But if you just type in the name of it, I'm sure you'll find a bunch of sellers that all have this on offer. So it's just an interesting bit of photographic equipment for you to think outside the box, do something different, take apart a lens and put it back together. There's inventiveness for you. And that might spark your creativity.
That's the ultimate photo geekery.
Exactly. So Steve, you said you had a tip as well that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, I was shooting a show, Rob Zombie and Marilyn Manson, with a band opening called Deadly Apples. And there was, I see this rarely, but there was a photographer in the pit that didn't have veer plugs in. And doing what I do for a living, most people just use foam earplugs. Some of them, you know, spend $35 to get, you know, quote unquote, musician's earplugs that are really over the counter, just special flanged earplugs with some of them do have filters in them, audio filters in them for either 9, 15 or 25 dB reduction. But my tip is, A, if you're a music photographer, make sure that you wear earplugs and always keep a spare in your bag, because if you lose one, you need something in that ear, right? Myself, I actually went out and I paid for custom molded earplugs. And it is hands down the best investment I made. Before I did that, I probably went through two or three $35 sets of earplugs trying to find ones that fit my ears that I liked. I'd already spent $100.
How much did it cost to get them custom formed?
$200.
Well, I mean, that's probably the cheapest thing in your camera bag.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, depending on who you go through. So some companies, like the ones I use are Sensaphonics. Usually for Sensaphonics, you have to go to an audiologist. You'll pay $100 to $150 for an impression of your ears where they inject into your ears, not a comfortable experience, and then maybe $150 for the plugs. There's another company, very well known, and a lot of musicians use them, Ultimate Ears. And with Ultimate Ears, it's $200. Here in Southern California, for example, you go to Ultimate Ears. They use what is basically ultrasound to image your ear as you stand there. And for $200, you get the ultrasound image. And within a week or so, you get your custom molded earplugs. And you can get them with either 9 or 15 or 25 dB filters in them that are interchangeable. You can change them. So if you're shooting jazz, you might go with the 9. And if you're shooting Rob Zombie, you definitely want the 25s. But the advantage over that from a, this is where the photography part comes in. If you're photographing a band and you put in foam earplugs, you can't necessarily hear all the frequencies right. It's a deadened experience. So you can't follow the vocals as well to understand the crescendos of the music to time what's happening. When you put in earplugs like this, I can leave them in and hold a conversation.
Oh, wow.
And I can completely hear the vocals of the band just safely. And that enables me to experience the music in a way that you can better get into the music and time your imagery. But really the tip is just whatever you do, wear earplugs, because it's important you only have one pair of
ears. Right. Yeah. You can't get those replaced. That's a great tip. And thank you for sharing that with us, Steve. Just final words here. I'm traveling to Princeton, New Jersey. I leave tomorrow and I will be holding some workshops, one on infrared photography, some macro photography workshops. Some of them are sold out. If anybody's listening to this and wants to get in last minute to the infrared workshop, there might be some spots still available. That's coming up on Saturday. And fun opportunity that I have. On my way down, I'm stopping into Newark to the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And one of the assistant professors there, I can't remember if he was listening to this podcast or heard me somewhere else, but was very interested in allowing me to use some of the equipment that he has access to at the university. It's an industrial CT scanner. It's not designed for human use. It's designed to, you know, use x-rays to probe into fossils and meteorites or whatever it happens to be. And so I'm going to have a fun little experiment trying to take x-ray photos of flowers on Friday afternoon. So that's going to be a fun little bit for me. I have no idea what's going to come of that. I might even try to bring a camera to see if I can x-ray a camera. Getting access to x-ray cameras is not exactly easy. You can't just go out and buy one. So that's a fun opportunity. And I'll be sharing the results of that when I have them.
Sounds good.
And Steve, what's coming up for you?
Well, all the normal stuff, the podcast, BehindTheShot.tv. You can find me on social media. It's Steve Brazel almost everywhere, but it's spelled like the country Brazil, but there's two L's. It's that on Instagram and on Twitter, where I spend most of my time is Twitter and Instagram. And then on Facebook, it's Steve Brazel Photography. Just recording shows. I've got some good ones coming up here. I've just aired a couple that I really, really like. I'm going to be taking a trip, actually, up where you're going, New England area, actually. Going to do some Chicago visiting and then going to hit Boston. And we're going to drive up to Maine from Boston. I've never been up through Vermont or Maine, and we're doing it in October. So it should be a beautiful time.
It'll be beautiful, yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm not really a landscape photographer, but I'm going to try.
I look forward to seeing your attempts at it, and maybe we can discuss that when you're on the show at a future date. But thank you so much.
Sounds
again for jumping on to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. Again, you can find my work at donkom.ca, donkom.ca, or Photo Geek Weekly for the show notes for this podcast. So with all of that said, it's time to get out and shoot.